It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. What is milk? It's a serious question these days. There are dozens of products on the market that call themselves milk, but are they? That's what we're going to look into this morning on The Morning Show. Do you prefer plant-based dairy alternatives to milk like almond milk or soy milk? Why do you? Do you notice a difference in the way you feel? Tell us about that. If you prefer dairy milk over plant-based alternatives, why is that? Do you think the FDA's move to consider whether to control which products can or can't call themselves milk is less about helping consumers and more about helping the dairy industry? And why is that? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Scott Rankin is a professor of food science and chair of the department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning, Scott, and welcome to The Morning Show.
Hi, John. Good morning. Thanks for the invitation to speak with you at your show.
So how does the Food and Drug Administration define milk?
Well, that's a good question. In the federal regulations, they have a definition of milk that speaks towards the variety of things, including like the health of the animals and how it's handled and heat treated. It talks about its composition. It also refers to a document called the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance, which is nearing 500 pages long of regulations, dictating really what, everything about the whole process, the state of the farm, the state of the milking, systems, how the milk is handled and trucked and processed and labeled, et cetera, et cetera. And so the FDA looks at it with a very, very sort of rigorous set of standards, I guess you'd say. And so that's, again, if we talk about milk in the U.S., that's, it's really dictated by hundreds of pages of regulations.
But at the end of the day, the FDA says that milk comes from healthy cows.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So like one of those elements is talks about, where milk comes from. And so in the federal regulations, it talks about cows. In the Wisconsin state regulations, it really talks about, it refers to milking animals, so expanding from cows include, sheep and goats and others or lactating animals. So that, again, that definition of milk in the state of Wisconsin is a little bit broader than is in the current federal regulations.
So, Scott, for you, what makes milk milk? I mean, do you define milk in a similar way to the way the FDA defines it?
Well, I guess I don't really have a private interpretation of it. I kind of am respectful of the regulations that are in place that talk about the long list of stuff that I've sort of mentioned, where it originates from, how it's handled and processed, and I have to be certainly respectful of the milk producers, the dairy farmers who, this is their livelihood, and they've been abiding by these rules for so many decades. And so I've always looked at milk, and again, really with the same set of eyes that the federal and state governments in the U.S. define milk, and that is again in reference to the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance and other either model or regulations that sort of dictate what milk looks like.
I my father grew up on a dairy farm. I did not, but my father grew up milking cows, and if he were still with us, if he walked into the grocery store and saw some of these products identifying themselves as milk, I don't know if he would laugh or shout, but he wouldn't be too happy about it. How has our culture's understanding of milk evolved over time?
I think in some ways we look at with milk. Going back to my childhood, I didn't really think twice about what milk was. I mean, it's this white liquid that you pour over your cereal in the morning and enjoy with Oreo cookies or whatever. But behind all of that have always existed all these regulations that say, you know, it has to be processed in a certain way, handled in a certain way. The farm has to be designed in a certain way and managed in a certain way, and is all this infrastructure around what milk looks like. In spite of what, you know, average Joe or Jane consumer may think about milk, what we call it in the U.S. is quote-unquote milk, again, has all this sort of background that we may or may not understand it, but it certainly exists and has existed for several years. And so I think, you know, again, the consumer's perspective may be very you know, may not understand like all that background and kind of look at milk as like I did when, you know, when I was younger, and it just, you know, a liquid that you pour on your cereal or you know, put a dollop in your you know, coffee or tea in the morning, and away you go. And so so I think as consumers look, you know, without the background and understanding of what milk looks like from a regulatory standpoint, you know, if you look at it like a functional white beverage kind of a thing, I think they may look at it more broadly than is currently defined in the regulations. And so I think that sort of opens the door for other types of materials being brought in and also called or referred to or including in the labeling a quote-unquote milk product.
Scott Rankin is a professor of food science and chair of that department at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about what milk is and isn't. Dennis wants to join us from Two Rivers. Let's go there now. Dennis, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. I figure if somebody's going to use it, they ought to read what's on the label. And if they read what's on the label, they're going to know it's a milk substitute. It's not something that's from an animal.
All right, Dennis, thanks. Scott Rankin, if you look at the label, you'll know it's not milk.
Right. No, that's a wonderful point that Dennis is making here in the sense that, we all ought to be very thoughtful about what we're putting, you know, what we're consuming. So, and I would encourage, you know, anyone who is looking at, you know, goes to the quote-unquote, you know, the traditional dairy case and sees this plethora of different, you know, beverages, including milk, but right next to them there will be, you know, soy and almond and cashew and so forth. But I would, you know, very much encourage consumers to be thoughtful about what the label looks like, not only from understanding what it is, but understanding what the ingredients are, and understanding what the nutrient densities are. So if you're looking, you know, if you're looking for, you know, for whatever reason, if you're looking for, a product that contains a certain amount of protein, for instance, I think you'd be, you know, I don't think you can go to that same dairy case now full of non-animal milks and be, quote-unquote, assured that everything has the same amount of protein. As well as other, you know, categories mm-hmm. of nutrients. So, yes, Dennis's counsel is very wise. Make sure you're reading the labels.
All right. We're talking about the question, what is milk? What do you think milk is? Should plant-based alternatives be able to call themselves milk? They can't do it in Europe or in Canada. Look it up. We're talking with Scott Rankin, professor of food science and chair of the Department of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our conversation about what is and isn't milk continues in a moment. What do you think should be called milk? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at The Morning Show. Excuse me, mornings on, I don't know, tweet us. We're there somewhere. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. What is milk? Well, that's the question under discussion on The Morning Show today. Do you prefer plant-based dairy alternatives? Why? If you prefer dairy milk over plant-based alternatives, why? What should be able to call itself milk? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking with Scott Rankin, a professor of food science and chair of that department at UW-Madison, about what milk is and isn't. The FDA is currently taking public comments, Scott, to see if consumers understand the difference between dairy and plant-based products that use words like milk, cheese, and yogurt on their labels. Their intention is whether to assess whether it needs to crack down on the plant-based products usage of those words so consumers aren't confused. And I threw this in just before the break. In the European Union, plant-based products are not allowed to use any words normally associated with dairy, like milk, cheese, or yogurt. I think the same is true also in Canada. But, Scott, what do we know about why consumers turn to plant-based alternatives?
Yeah, well, and there are certainly, you know, a collection of reasons why. They may do it for, you know, reasons, so for health reasons, for instance. Some individuals may have significant allergies to milk proteins and are, you know, to them, you know, the consumption of, you know, a dairy product, milk, you know, containing milk proteins, that type of thing could have significant health implications. Others may avoid them for the presence of milk sugar or lactose. And in other words, these may be individuals who have difficulty digesting lactose and decide to avoid dairy products because of that. And so you know, there are a host of other reasons why they may choose to go for a non-animal beverage. You know, they're very legitimate. And I think sort of the challenge is that, you know, if we have all these products that are labeled milk, so again, I think there are very wise, thoughtful reasons why people would avoid the traditional, you know, animal milk, you know, bovine milk, for instance, that you buy at the supermarket. But I think the, you know, the controversy resides, well, who can use the term milk, though? And if you apply the term milk to the host of different, you know, beverages, including, you know, bovine milk and you know, soy and so forth, does that, you know, does that allowance of the use of milk then, you know, mislead individuals into thinking, well, they're all just milk, so I'm just going to consume anyone and they'll be fine? Well, you know, I think the biggest challenge is that, you know, there's such a variety of nutrient, you know, densities in these different products that I think that's where the, you know, the controversy resides. Whereas milk has these very, very rigorous standards of how it's made and its standard of identity and its composition. And, you know, you go to the store any day and you will be assured that that you'll have the same sort of nutrient density day in and day out, and no matter what milk you buy from what manufacturers. But almond and soy and you know, the non-animal milks don't have that sort of structure around them. So what are you getting? You know, I think Dennis's, your earlier callers mentioned, you know, read the label, and that's very wise. But if you're not reading labels, you know, and you just say, well, I need some milk, well, you won't be getting the same thing in terms of nutrient density. I think that's where the trouble resides in applying, or one of the problems with applying or allowing the use of milk for all these different alternative, you know, beverages.
Paul is with us in Washington County. Paul, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. I think this guy is a promoter, the shill for the growing dairy industry. Hey, look, milk's a generic term. It's not copyrighted. It's not trademarked. And I meander into the dairy, or the, yeah, I think it's called the dairy aisle, and you see, you see milk. Well, why don't they call it the Guernsey milk or goat milk or yak milk? You have to. It's a generic term, and you have to further define it. So you got cashew almond milk or wheat/oat milk, which I've seen and I've tried. It's very good. And if you do an analysis of the nutrients, you know what kind of protein, mineral content, it's probably better for the environment to have these grain milks and nut milks. They're not going through a organic digestive system that's polluting the soil and the water. mix. So this is the dairy industry, which is being consolidated into, you know, like 5,000 herd farms where they can't even handle the waste material in a responsible manner. So my point is, somebody got to, you know, tell them that get over it. You have to further define milk.
All right. The dairy industry needs to just get over it because these other milks are here and they are milk, and that's that. Dairy farmers, of course, and producers have big industry groups in their corner pushing to protect their interests. How does that play out then in front of the FDA? Who's got the upper hand here?
Yeah, no, Culler has a good point in the sense that, you know, milk can be applied to a million things, and you just need to be you know, a wise consumer about what's out there. And I guess, you know, so in terms of animal milks, whether it's, you know, a cow or sheep or goat, when you go to the store and you buy that gallon, they're very rigid definitions about how that product comes to be. And, but if, so again, you go to the store and you buy 2% milk from, you know, any processor, any different brand, and because they all have to abide these regulations, you know you're getting the same thing. If you go to buy soy milk or almond milk or, you know, or another, you know, plant-based milk, you don't have that assurance. So they don't abide what, you know, we would refer to as a standard of identity. So again, that's where the rub is, right? So you go to buy animal milk, and you're assured that you're getting a product that meets this hundreds of pages of code that say, here's how you make milk. So if you come along and say, well, we're going to put, you know, a plant-based product into this, and we'll color it white, and you know, put milk on it too, well, that's where the difficulty is, right? Well, what are you getting? You know, and certainly, you know, reading the label and all that stuff is good, but I think, you know, the FDA is looking at that and saying, well, you know, this term milk, you know, we already have a definition for it. And so, and that's how, you know, Canada and other countries have looked at it and say, well, no, you can't just say, well, we're milk too. You know, milk has already been defined. And I think that's the sort of the basis of the Dairy Pride Act that Tammy Baldwin is working on, and it essentially says that, you know, we're just going to force the regulations that already exist that say, well, here's the definition of milk, we already have that, and so essentially excluding the products that are, you know, get there through some other route.
We had an email from Peter, who is from Reedsburg, and the slug on his email: remember the colored oleo wars, here we go again, hashtag dairy industry nonsense. Peter points out that in 1895, the state legislature passed a law forbidding the manufacture or sale of butter-colored oleo or margarine. Not too long later, farmers marched to the Capitol to block a system for bringing yellow oleo into the state. People used to have to sneak it across the border from Minnesota and Iowa and Illinois and Michigan. Does this resistance remind you of what's going on now, Scott?
You know, I guess I don't really, you know, I look at it from the standpoint of, you know, if you go into the store and you buy a gallon of milk from a regulatory standpoint or otherwise, you should be, I think, you know, average consumers should be assured that they're getting the same thing day in and day out. And if you open the door on that to include other things, and it applies to either butter or, the margarine type products, you know, you're not getting the same thing from a nutritional standpoint. And so, can you still use the same name and the same presence in the dairy case and things like that? You know, I don't want to be dismissive of the opinion that, well, look, you know, milk we can apply to a million things and so forth, but from a regulatory standpoint, you know, we have to be very thoughtful about what we allow to use, you know, these sort of dairy terms. And I appreciate the dairy industry's position. You know, they have to abide these hundreds of pages of regulations, and they work very hard to make sure that every day, you know, milk, cheese, et cetera, meet those standards. And so if you get there you know, if you're wanting to compete in that market, you know, the dairy industry has this enormous regulatory burden to live by and abide by. And if you get there from some circuitous route and also call it milk, I can certainly understand the tension there.
Got less than a minute left, about 30 seconds. Do you think the FDA will ultimately decide to restrict language around milk?
You know, I think they're looking at it very closely. I think, you know, how this will come out, I'm not quite sure. But in many cases, in the food industry, it really, you know, at the end of the day, we often take take a position that reflects a very global movement. And I would say, as Canada and Europe have been doing, we
all
might
right.
follow suit.
We'll leave it there, Scott. Scott Rankin, thank you for joining us this morning.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Scott is professor of food science and chair of the department at the UW-Madison. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Natural disasters. It's a catch-all term that can include hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes. However, a growing number of scientists believe that may be an inaccurate way to describe our increasingly intense storms. Why? Climate change. What do you think of the increasing number of intense hurricanes? Do you make a connection between damaging weather events and climate change? What do you think society should do to protect those in vulnerable areas? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kerry Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Kerry, welcome to the morning show.
Nice to be here with you.
So how long have we been studying the rising intensity of hurricanes?
Well, the first real paper on this was published a little bit more than 30 years ago, and that paper predicted that as the climate warms, we should begin to see more intense hurricanes.
So what did hurricanes of past generations look like compared to today's storms?
Well, we wish we had a better idea of that. The problem with hurricane records is that they're not very complete, and as you go back in time, measurements of hurricanes get worse and worse. So it's very hard to know. We've had some really violent hurricanes in our past. The worst natural disaster in the history of the United States remains the 1900 Galveston hurricane, whose storm surge destroyed the city and killed between 6,000 and 8,000 people. But we don't know exactly how intense the storm was because we weren't really measuring them at the time. So we have a hard time picking out long-term trends from the actual historical records.
But we have noticed an increase in intensity since we did start keeping records. How quickly has that increase happened?
Well, in the Atlantic, particularly the last 25 years, is a very clear signal of increasing intensity. It's not at all clear that particular signal has to do with the phenomenon we call global warming. It may very well be due actually to another anthropogenic effect, which is aerosol pollution. We managed to clean up the atmosphere beginning in the 1980s, principally, and that's actually had the effect of allowing more sunlight to be absorbed by the tropical Atlantic. And some of us, but not everyone, thinks that the big uptick in intensity in the Atlantic is due to the Clean Air Act. Not that any of us feels we ought to repeal that. I want to point out that only about 11% of the world's tropical cyclones occur in the Atlantic, so we have to pay attention to what's going on elsewhere.
And what is going on elsewhere? Are we seeing more intense hurricanes or tropical storms in the Pacific, the other oceans?
Well, yes, in a guarded way, I think we are. Now, perhaps the best records, the most stable records we've had beginning around 1980 were records based upon satellite observations. They have the enormous benefit of being globally uniform. Of course, satellites have improved over time, and our ability to detect hurricane intensity has likewise improved. But we're beginning to see upward trends in the intensity of the high-category hurricanes. If we look at storms that don't reach intensities much more than about 100 miles per hour, we don't see any trends. But if we look at storms that get more intense, we see their upward trends in those. Now, the problem is hurricanes are rare. So if you take into account all the problems of measuring them and their rarity, that upward trend could be argued. But it is consistent with predictions based on really basic theory that we made 30 years ago. So it gives us some confidence we're beginning to see those.
Well, hurricanes are rare events, but are we seeing more of them besides more intense storms? Are they happening more frequently now than they used to?
No, not at all, not globally. If we look at the global hurricane counts, and again, we're very confident of that number, since about 1980, not that long ago, it's been very stable. The expectations based on theory and modeling are very inconsistent about whether the total number of storms should go up or even down, with an actual consensus that there might actually be a decrease. On the other hand, what matters to society most are the changes in the frequency of the intense hurricanes. The weak hurricanes that may get up to 80 miles per hour or so typically don't cause that many problems, so we're more concerned about tendencies in the higher categories of hurricanes.
Do we? What's the evidence that these more intense storms are linked to climate change? And why do scientists believe that the two are linked if they are?
Well, I think the primary basis for that belief rests upon basic theory, which, of course, is hard to describe to people outside the field, but it's fairly robust. And I can describe it a little bit. The theory basically says, and this is confirmed by observations, that given a certain temperature of the ocean and a temperature profile in the atmosphere, there is a speed limit, an upper bound on how strong you can make the winds in a hurricane. And when we calculate that upper bound, which varies from place to place and time to time, even in the current climate, we see that, indeed, it's almost impossible to find hurricanes that exceed the speed limit, although most of them don't make it up close to that speed limit, fortunately. But the theory is fairly robust as to that speed limit, and the theory, again, going back 30 years, predicts that as you warm the tropical oceans, that speed limit should go up rather perceptibly. So we're comfortable with that theory as far as it goes. The models have the problem that the global models don't have enough resolution, computational resolution, really to get intense hurricanes. They can model weak storms. We're only now just beginning to get to the point of being able to model intense hurricanes. And the ones that do consistently show that the more intense storms become more frequent over time. They're less consistent in their predictions of the numbers of weak storms, which in any case dominate the total number of storms in any place.
What's the relationship between our rising sea level and hurricanes?
Well, there's no particular relationship in the sense that rising sea level doesn't affect hurricanes. We don't expect to see any effect at all. But on the other hand, it has very important implications for the most deadly part of a hurricane historically, which is the storm surge. I mentioned a while back that's what destroyed the city of Galveston in 1900. It was a big problem in Hurricane Katrina, for example. And it is the largest killer. It is the same phenomenon as a tsunami, and many listeners will have seen the horrible videos of the tsunamis that we've had in recent times in places like Japan and the Indian Ocean. It's the same thing, except that it's caused by wind rather than shaking earth. But hydrodynamically, it's the same thing. And if you can imagine a tsunami arriving in the middle of a hurricane or a typhoon, that's what you're up against. And as sea level rises, the tsunamis are riding on top of an elevated surface. They go further inland and they cause more damage. It's not much more complicated than that.
Carrie Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Carrie, what is your opinion on calling hurricanes natural disasters?
Well, I've never liked that term, and, you know, quite apart from the whole problem of climate change, it's kind of a cop-out. Nature has had hurricanes and other meteorological phenomena for as long as there's been nature. Nature is well adapted hurricanes. There are places like southern Florida, there are ecosystems that arguably to some extent depend upon there being a hurricane once in a while, just as there are forests that depend upon there being fires once in a while. So nature is fine with hurricanes. It's us that we're the problem, and we build in and live in places that are at risk to hurricanes and other natural phenomena. The phenomenon happens, the structures get destroyed, and then we call that an act of God or a natural phenomenon. So it kind of takes attention away from where we really need to direct it, which is, you know, toward the policies that we have in place, which, at least in the case of the United States, actively encourage, in some sense, subsidize people to live in risky places. And while those policies are in place, we're going to have more and more so-called natural disasters, whether the climate change affects them or not.
So what should we call them instead?
Well, I think we should call the disasters what they are. They're disasters that occur. I don't have a good name for them off the top of my head, but they're the disasters that occur because of unwise policies more than anything else. You know, if someone building an ordinary condominium near the beach in a hurricane-prone place had to pay an insurance premium that actually reflected the risk, they wouldn't be able to afford it. And so in the U.S., oddly enough, with all the proponents for free markets, we have absolutely nothing like a free market in insurance. And we're actively stopping the pricing of insurance. The premiums should be sending the signals of risk to people who are contemplating building something or buying something in a hurricane-prone area. We stop that signal. That's the disaster. That right there is the cause of the disaster. If we didn't have that, insurance premiums would be very high, so you'd either not build or buy there. Or if you did build, if you could afford to, you'd build a fortress that really could take a Cat 5 storm in a place like Florida.
When are natural disasters not natural? That discussion continues in a moment. What do you think? Should we call these natural disasters, or if we put our house in the path of a hurricane, do we, you know, can we really call it a natural disaster? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Gary Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. He stays with us. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes, we lump them all together and call them natural disasters. But a growing number of scientists say not so fast. This may not be an accurate way to describe our increasingly intense storms. What do you think of the increasing number of intense hurricanes and other weather phenomena? Do you make a connection between these damaging weather events and climate change? And what do you think society should do to protect those who live in vulnerable areas? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kerry Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. Kerry, we've seen an uptick in much more intense storms, not just hurricanes, but just in Wisconsin, for example. We've now had about four so-called 100-year rains in the last few years. Lots more flooding, fewer rainstorms, but way more intense. Is that something we can also expect due to the way our climate is changing?
Absolutely. It's one of the more robust findings of climate science, and it's not based on primarily on complicated models, but just very basic theory that as you warm the climate, rainfall gets concentrated in more intense but less frequent events. I mean, the overall sort of global annual average rainfall goes up a little bit, not a lot. The main change is in the concentration of the events. So there's kind of an irony in it. We expect to see both more floods and more droughts, and we're beginning to see that fairly clearly in certain data sets. This is important globally because it greatly affects the availability of water and indirectly of food. And scarcities of water and food historically have been major instigators of things like armed conflict. So, for example, our Defense Department is very worried about that particular aspect of climate change.
Let's talk about something called negative adaptation. And I think we probably touched on this earlier, but it bears repeating. How do government policies encourage negative adaptation?
Well, they encourage it principally through the provision of cheap insurance and the failure to price insurance correctly. So in the U.S., this is a particular problem, much worse than you find anywhere else in the world. And basically, people who live particularly along the U.S. East Coast, right on the beach, are wealthier and more influential, let's say, than people living inland. So they hammer away on politicians to regulate private insurance in such a way that the rates are kept low. And similarly, in the provision of federal flood insurance, which covers all of the storm surge damage and rain-induced flooding damage for hurricanes, they hammer away at politicians to make sure that the rates aren't high in coastal areas. So let me give you a concrete example. Congress tried to reform this back in 2012 with something called the Biggert Waters Act, which implemented a pricing scheme in which premiums more accurately reflected the actual risk. And there was such a pushback from coastal homeowners that Congress largely repealed that act. They didn't actually repeal the act itself, but they took back a lot of the more serious provisions. So we're stuck in this mold, and as long as we're in this policy realm, we just going to have more and more human disasters.
Now let's take a call from John in Richland Center. John, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John, and congratulations on your morning talk show. I'm sure that your father would be proud of you.
Well, thank you.
And I have a question for your guest, and I'm a former, as a disclosure, that I'm a former chief inspector, City of La Crosse. It was my job to prevent people from building in a floodplain, and if they did, they had to make sure that the elevation was correct so they would get insurance for the banks, and that keeps the economy running. I know that sunspots are a big problem. I've had a NASA scientist who had decades at NASA. He told me that sunspot cycles cause the ice ages, and we're entering another ice age cycle, which is going to make the climate get much colder. And if you talk about an act of God, meteors that crash down are acts of God. Hurricanes causes floods.
Okay. John, we get it. What about sunspot activity, Carrie?
Well, the variations of the Earth's orbit around the sun and wobbles of the Earth's axis of rotation are responsible for ice ages. I think that's what the caller was alluding to. And it is true that on a very long time scale, if it weren't for the fact that we're suddenly pumping a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we're in a very slow descent toward the next ice age. But we're talking about 10,000, 20,000 years. Whereas the greenhouse warming, we're talking about 100 years. So what we're doing is producing a big upward spike that will not prevent the next ice age. But the next ice age is 10,000 years off. The problem we're confronting now is right now, and it will be for the next few thousand years because of greenhouse gases. So we're talking about different time scales. So you know, in some sense, it's all of the above. But our current problem is clearly with the greenhouse gases.
And there's a good chance I won't still be on the radio 10,000 years from now.
Yeah.
Although some might argue that. Let's talk about, well, we talked about the intensity of hurricanes. We talked about rainstorms and flooding that we're seeing. Is climate change also impacting other events like tornadoes, for example?
Well, my profession has only just begun to tackle this important question of how climate change affects severe thunderstorms, which produce tornadoes, and hail. Hail is actually produces more damage, though not more loss of life, than tornadoes in the U.S. So hail is important, particularly to agriculture. And I've actually looked into this a bit, and what we find is that the wetness of the soil, sort of average quantity we call soil moisture, which very recently we've learned how to measure from satellites, is a critical component in severe weather. It's not the only component. And so what happens largely depends upon how climate change affects that quantity, and we're only beginning to learn that. So what we see is that as the climate warms in general, but it varies a lot from place to place, it might actually be harder to form severe storms, but the severe storms that form can be more violent. That's sort of a general statement, but it varies a lot from place to place.
We've got about a minute or so left here, Carrie. The UN recently published a harrowing climate report that detailed the consequences we would see if the Earth warms 2 degrees Celsius, which it very well could. What would hurricanes look like if we reached that level of warming?
Well, I think the calculations we've done suggest that on average, you know, the wind speed, you know, might be another 10 miles per hour larger, which doesn't sound like a lot. But when you go from 140 miles per hour to 150 miles per hour, you actually get a lot more damage. So I think that those would not be very good hurricanes to have to experience.
And do you have any sense that there's any will in on the part of policymakers to change some of this negative adaptation that we've been talking about?
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
All right. Well, that's a great answer, and I think that probably is where we could leave this. It's a question policymakers will have to answer at some point. And we can have that discussion another day. Carrie Emanuel, professor of atmospheric science at MIT, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Been a pleasure.
You are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More to come. Stick with us. I'm John Munson.